We're working through Luke's Gospel together. We're in chapter 6. Jesus is speaking to a large crowd of disciples, people who say they believe in him and follow him. He's warned them that if they really are his disciples, then they're going to be ill-treated. They're going to be persecuted by the people around them. Verse 22, "Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man." That's what they must expect if they are really his disciples. And then he goes on to tell them how they must react when people ill-treat them in this way. Verse 27, "But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." And he gives specific examples of how they must show love to the people who hate them. Verse 29, "If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other cheek also. If someone takes your cloak, don't stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, don't demand it back." The rule for Jesus' followers is not do to others what they have done to you. The rule for Jesus' followers is the rule he gives in verse 7. Do to others what you would like them to do to you. That's the point we reached last week. Jesus has put in front of his disciples these radical, risky, you might almost say ridiculous standards. You know, surely you can't really go through the world like this, trying to love everyone, getting hurt and then coming back for more and getting hurt again and again. But that's exactly what Jesus is telling them that they've got to do. When someone they're trying to care for smacks them in the face, they don't step back into their safety zone. They stay where they are, knowing that whoever it was might do it a second time. Someone they're trying to help steals their jacket. Well, they don't back off and say, "Well, I'm never going to risk going near that person again." No, they go back knowing that this time he may steal their shirt. Jesus is saying, acting lovingly towards nasty people, crooked people, unstable people is always risky. You're liable to get hurt, and you're liable to get hurt over and over again, but you still do it. You expose yourself to that. We had this in a tiny way yesterday. You know, we organised this men's breakfast. And an awful lot of time and trouble goes into preparing for it. I mean, James spends hours, I don't know how long, 3, 4, 5 hours, buying the food and preparing it and cooking it. And hours go into booking the speaker and preparing the invitations and getting them out. And it takes 2 or 3 hours to set the place up and lay the tables and so on. And we know that afterwards there'll be a couple of hours washing dishes and cleaning up and all those things. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of effort. But we've said that we'll do it because we think it's a good thing. We think it's a caring thing to offer men an attractive meal and to invite them to sit down with us as friends. It's a way of offering them friendship. And it's an even better thing to tell them that we've got good news for them, good news about Jesus Christ. Well, yesterday, one man promises he'll be there, and we make detailed arrangements with him. He'll take a bus into Stockport, he'll be there at 8:30 in the morning, and we'll pick him up and we'll take him to the meal. It's awkward and it's inconvenient because it's the busiest time, just when we're supposed to be preparing. But we're glad to do it. It's a gesture to show that we really want him there. It's a signal of friendship. So there we are, sitting in the car in Stockport at the appointed time, in the appointed place. At 8:25, there's no sign of him. At 8:30, there's no sign of him. At 8:35, there's no sign. At 8:40, there's no sign. and we ring and he's not answering his phone, and he's not responding to messages or texts, and finally we've got to go, and it's frustration. He's broken his promise to us. But there are compensations, aren't there? We've been down to the local hostel, and we've given a personal invitation to each of the lads who live there. Again, we want to show them that we care about them. Nobody else is really interested in these lads. Most of them have been disowned by their own families. And what a lovely surprise. Two of these lads turn up. And they eat their way through the breakfast and they chat. And then I say, well, in 5 minutes I'm going to hand over to the speaker. And they say, oh, great, we'll just slip out for a smoke. See you in a minute. And off they go. And head straight off down the road. They didn't have to lie to us. They didn't have to say, see you in a minute. But they did. They could have just said, we've got to go, but thank you. But they couldn't be bothered to say thank you. But still, there were other visitors sitting at the table. So, oh, it's still worth it, isn't it? And they listened to what the speaker had to say. And then we invited questions or comments. And one of them started to talk. I think he had enjoyed his breakfast. But the moment he opened his mouth, he started to rant. And within a minute or two, he had become angry and incoherent, shouting at us all, swearing at us all. Not about anything the speaker had done, not about anything we had done. But still, he raved on at us. And finally, he stormed out. So we've tried to show friendship to a number of men. And how have they reacted? Well, one guy has let us down. He can't keep his promises. And two more young men have exploited us and lied to us and shown themselves completely ungrateful. And another one has shouted abuse at us, though we've not done anything to him except welcomed him and fed him and treated him as a friend. Now, is it worth organising events for men like these? People who treat you like that. And is it worth trying to befriend those particular men? Do we carry on trying to show love to people like that? To those particular people? Jesus says, you've got to. It's a simple, flat command from the Lord Jesus. These men have smacked you in the face, says Jesus. And Jesus, our Master, our Lord, simply commands us to go back to them, knowing that they could smack us in the face again, knowing that they could break their promises to us again, knowing that they could lie to us again, knowing that they could shout abuse at us again. The guy who walked out has cursed us. Well, Jesus has simply ordered us to bless him, to speak words of blessing to him. Jesus doesn't leave us any options about how we deal with people like that. He has simply told us flatly that we must carry on showing love to those men. Doesn't mean necessarily that we invite them to another men's breakfast. That may not be the best thing for them, or for other people who might be invited. But we have got to find some way of expressing our loving care for those particular men. And the harder they smacked us in the face, the more determined we've got to be to do it. We cannot restrict our caring, our loving, to people who we think deserve it, or people who will respond to it rightly. We can't restrict it to people who treat us well or kindly or generously. That's the standard of the world. But it's not Jesus' standard. Verse 32, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Jesus says even sinners love those who love them. Non-Christians, godless people, even people who've got very few moral standards. Sinners, they're capable of loving people who love them in return. They're capable of caring for people who care about them. Jesus says there's no credit to you if you reach that standard. sinners, he goes on to say, do good to those who do good to them. They lend to people who can be trusted to pay them back. That's the sensible, reasonable standard of the world. And if you live up to that standard, then people in the world will say, oh, you know, he's a really decent bloke. But Jesus says, my standards are different. You have got to love your enemies, he says. And he repeats it here. You've got to love your enemies. You've got to love the people who deliberately hurt you. You've got to love the people who are out to harm you. You do good to them. He says you lend to people who you know have got it in for you. And you suspect that they're going to cheat you. Or they're so unstable or so unreliable that you can never expect them to pay you back. That's the absurd, impossible standard that Jesus sets. And he means it. These are just as definite commands as do not kill or do not commit adultery. A Christian who is not actively loving his enemies, who is unwilling to lend to them or do good to them, is just as disobedient as a Christian who is unfaithful to his wife. Let's imagine a scenario. One of those lads from the hostel who treated us so rudely yesterday, who showed themselves so unreliable. Imagine that one of them comes to see me and he tells me that he's desperate to get a job. And he's been offered a place on a training course. But it costs. He's got to pay a hefty fee up front. No doubt that it would be good for him to go on that course. No doubt that it's what he needs, but he's penniless. And he's tried all the obvious sources and none of them can help him. So he wants to know, can I lend him the money? Well, that's just cheek, isn't it? After the way he behaved yesterday, for him to come to me and expect me to lend him the money, that is unreasonable, isn't it? What do I have to do in that situation? Well, I think I would check out if it was just a lie that he was spinning. I'd find out about the course. I'd check that he really has got a place on it. But if it's real, what am I going to do? Well, my master, to whom I'm answerable, my master who has entrusted money into my hands, every penny that I have, my master's already given me his instructions. Verse 30, give to everyone who asks you. Verse 35, love even your enemies. Do good to them and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. He's not left me any loopholes. It's not my money to refuse to lend, it's his. And he simply told me to do it. Now, all right, I'm not going to put the money into this lad's hands and expose him to the temptation of misusing it. I'll pay it direct to the college or whatever. But I've not got the option of saying no to him. I'm not authorized to. Jesus has told me in the simplest and plainest words what I've got to do. But that's silly. I mean, it's impossible. It's unreasonable. It's irresponsible. You don't really think he would keep his promise and give you back the money, do you? No, I don't. But that's not my business. My business is simply to do what Jesus says and leave the consequences to him. But if you live like that, you'll finish up penniless yourself. Possibly. But Jesus says, verse 35, do it and your reward will be great. I don't think he means here in this world. He means in the world to come. And that's what faith is about. When you're willing to lose out here in this world by obeying Jesus' commandments, because you really believe in the rewards that Jesus gives in the world to come. Now, as we've already said, this is utterly different from the way the world operates. In the world, people do good to those who do good to them. They're nice to nice people. They show kindness to people who will show gratitude. They lend to people who can be trusted to repay. That's the world standard. But Jesus says that that his disciples don't live by the world's standard. So what standard are we expected to live by? If we're not going to borrow our standards from the world around us, where do we get them from? Where's the benchmark that we employ? Well, Jesus answers that question in verses 35 and 36. Love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back, then your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. That is the standard by which we are to live our lives. We don't behave according to what people around us think is a sensible, good standard. We don't live by the norms of our culture, our society. We make this our rule. I am going to be like God, my Father in heaven. I'm going to behave the way he behaves. I want my character and my behavior to be like his. One of the most fundamental ideas that the Bible teaches is that human beings were created to be like God. On the sixth day of creation, God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness." Man was created to be like God, a visible reflection of God's character. Of course, God is infinite. He's unlimited in every way. We're very much finite. We're limited in every way. But human beings are supposed to be finite likenesses of the infinite God. If you like, we're two-dimensional pictures of the infinitely dimensional God. God is wise and knows everything. Then human beings are supposed to be wise too, like God. We can't know everything because we're finite, but we can have true knowledge like God. God is powerful and can do everything. Well, then human beings are supposed to have strength and power like God. We can't have infinite power, but we can have real power. We're supposed to be able to do things, to achieve things. God is creative. He's infinitely creative. So human beings are supposed to be creative too. God is holy. So human beings are supposed to be holy. God is loving. He has been from all eternity. The Father has always loved the Son through the Holy Spirit. So human beings are supposed to be loving. Human beings are supposed to mirror God's being. They're his image bearers. Now, when Adam and Eve rebelled against God, God's image in them and their descendants was sadly spoiled. It's not completely vanished, but it's been badly damaged. And it's been damaged in every way. Human beings still have some knowledge, but it's very confused and it's mixed with false ideas and it's unreliable. Human beings still have power to do things, but their power is mixed with terrible weakness. And so often the power they do have, they use wrongly. Human beings are still creative, but so much of what they create is perverted and it's ugly. Human beings still love, but so often they love the wrong people and they love them in the wrong way. Human beings everywhere are a very poor reflection of what God is like. But when a fallen, damaged man or woman or child is joined to Jesus Christ, God's Son, and when Christ's Spirit comes to live in that person, then the Spirit begins to restore the damaged likeness, God's likeness, in that person. So step by step, that person becomes more like God himself. Paul talks about how Christians put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. That's Ephesians 4:23. If you're a real Christian, if you've trusted yourself as a sinner to Jesus Christ, then you've put on a new self. And that self is created to be like God again. You're being restored to be like God in true righteousness, real holiness. And that's why again and again in the New Testament, believers are told, be like God. Just as he who called you is holy, so you be holy in all you do. For it's written, be holy because I'm holy. That's 1 Peter 1, verses 15 and 16. Peter doesn't say, be as holy as the other Christians in the church. Or be as holy as the best Christians you've ever read about. He simply says, be holy as God is holy. Be like him. That's the standard. You've got to be as holy as he is. Or Ephesians 5:1, be imitators of God as dearly loved children. You're children of God, then you should be like him. So imitate him, says Paul. Imitate the way he acts. Imitate the way he treats people. Now here, Jesus brings that great principle into this matter of how we treat people who treat us badly, even our enemies. He says, you must be sons of the Most High. If God is your Father, then you must do as he does. You must be his true sons. You must be like him. You must live in line with the way that your Father lives. You know, if you really are a child of God, it's inevitable that this will happen. You know, Jesse is going to have a nose and eyes like his dad's. That is inevitable. And I'm afraid he's going to have a lot of the same mannerisms and stock phrases. And almost certainly he's going to have the same traits of character, or some of them, and the same interests. Inheritance shows. Whether you like it or not, inheritance shows. And if you really are a child of God, then it will show through. God's characteristics will begin to show through in you. Love, holiness, trustworthiness, truthfulness. If you're a real Christian, then you inherit these things from God your Father. But that doesn't mean that you don't work at it. You know, Jesse has simply inherited some things from me, involuntarily. But I still teach him. And I expect him deliberately to learn from me and to copy me. No, Jesse, that's not how you hold your knife and fork. Now look, look, see how I'm holding my knife. Look where my fingers are. Now put your fingers in the same place on your knife as my fingers are on my knife. He learns by deliberately imitating, copying his Father. And Jesus is telling us here that we have to copy our Father in heaven deliberately, even when it seems completely unnatural, completely strange to us. Having lived all those years in the world, by the world standards, it's going to seem strange, it's going to seem unnatural when you start copying God instead of copying the world. It's going to mean breaking all the patterns, all the conditioning of the past in order to copy God. Jesus tells us we've got to copy our Father, and it's going to be a deliberate, planned change. And Jesus applies this especially to the way we treat our enemies, to the way that we treat people when they treat us badly. How does God treat his enemies? How does God treat ungrateful people? How does God treat wicked people? Jesus says here in verse 35, he is kind to them. He is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. As long as they are here in this world, God is showing kindness to them. Now, they may not recognize that. You know, we meet lots of people who spend their time shouting about how unfair and unkind God is to them, how cruel he is, how much suffering God has brought into the world and into their lives. But Jesus says flatly, no, God is kind to them. And he is. You've only got to ask, what do human beings deserve from God after the way we treated him? Human beings, the human race, has rebelled against God. And we've insulted God in every conceivable way. God has shown human beings that he's there. They've only got to look up at the sky. They've only got to see the moon and the sun and the stars. They've only got to look at the wonders of creation. Birds, animals, the human body with all its astonishing complexity. All around them there's the evidence that there's one great, almighty, invisible, all-powerful, eternal God. But are they willing to worship him and honour him? No, they'll do anything except that. They'll invent their own horrible religions. You know, if they're Hindus, they'll worship 1,000 imaginary gods and goddesses. And they'll bow down before their wooden idols. And their widows will burn themselves alive at the behest of those gods and goddesses. Some of those gods and goddesses they'll worship are gods of violence and goddesses of lust. But they'll worship them rather than worship the one true God who put the stars in place. If they're Buddhists, they'll simply say there is no God out there. There is no creator of the world. God is simply the sum total of existence. They'll sit and meditate and try to escape from this world into a world in their own heads to avoid God, the real God. If they're atheists, they'll simply shout that God doesn't exist. And if they're normal British people, well, they'll say they believe in God, most of them, and they'll ignore him. Year after year after year, except at christenings and funerals. That's how human beings treat God. They break every one of his commandments. He gives them a conscience, and through their conscience he tells them that lying is wrong, and they tell lies. Tells them that stealing is wrong. And that's why they get very upset when anyone steals from them, because they know it's wrong. But they still steal themselves. Tells them that people should keep their promises. So they get very angry when their marriage partner cheats on them. They still feel free to break their promises when it suits them. They break every one of God's laws, which God has written on their hearts. Well, how do people like these deserve to be treated by God? Wouldn't it be fair for God just to ignore them the way that they've ignored him? Wouldn't it be fair of God just to withdraw completely and say, okay, I'm not going to do one more thing for them from this day on? Wouldn't that be fair? But he doesn't. He keeps them alive. He keeps them breathing. He keeps their hearts ticking. He gives them sleep at night. And he wakes them up in the morning. He keeps the sun shining to give them warmth and light. He makes the rain fall and seeds germinate in the ground so that they can have food. He gives them so many pleasures You know, however wretched a person's circumstances are, there are pleasures they still enjoy. The sunlight falling on their cheek, even a slave in the cave working away under horrible conditions can still feel the sunlight on their cheek and know that there's pleasure there. The taste of food, even if it's only dry bread on their lips, there's pleasure there. The touch of a human hand. God doesn't have to give one single moment of pleasure to any human being. But he does, because he's kind. He knows that human beings will misuse the good gifts that he gives to them. He gives an atheist, a Richard Dawkins, the power to think and write and express himself. And Dawkins uses it to write books, attacking God. Books saying that he doesn't need God. He can only write those books because God gives him the strength to do it. He gives people the capacity for sexual pleasure, and they pervert it and they turn it into lust and greed. He gives people food, and instead of restraining themselves and eating what they need, they stuff themselves in greed. But he still carries on giving them good gifts out of sheer kindness. And they're so ungrateful. They never thank him. They never acknowledge his kindness. They never repay him. But still he keeps giving. You know, we could be put out that those lads vanished yesterday without a word of thanks. God has to put up with that sort of behavior from millions of human beings every day and every hour of the day and every moment of the day. But he still keeps looking after them. Sometimes people come to him with requests. They've ignored him. They've never shown any interest in him. But now there's a crisis in their life. A member of the family is severely ill. Their marriage is on the rocks. Could be anything. And in this emergency, they come and they ask God for his help. Or they ask us to pray to God for them. And if God decides that it would be a real kindness, God gives them what they ask for. He answers the prayers, even of unbelievers. But once the emergency is over, do they show any gratitude? Do they show any love for God? No, they go right back to ignoring him. They go back to live for their own pleasures again. You know, we've seen that happen so many times, haven't we? You know, if I were to write a list of all the people who have come to us in a time of crisis, begging us to pray for them, it would be a very long list. And in many cases, our prayers have been answered. And God's been incredibly kind to those people. But afterwards, they've not wanted to know. Well, doesn't God know that people will turn out ungrateful? That they will use him in that way and then walk away? Yes, God knows. But it's as if God is so generous by nature that even knowing how people are going to react, he can't bring himself to say no to them. That's our God. He's unbelievably kind. He's amazingly generous. And Jesus says, be his children. Be like him. You know, as long as people are here in this world, God is caring for them. Think of the worst person you ever heard about or read about. You know, up to the moment when Adolf Hitler died, God was caring for that man. God was giving him a brain to think, and eyes to see, and ears to hear. God gave him a woman who loved him to be there with him through his last hours. God was giving him wonderful kindnesses. He was misusing them all. But God was caring for him up to his last moments in this world. We know that for every man or woman who refuses to make peace with God through Jesus Christ, there's a point when God says, it would be wrong for me to show any more kindness to this man, to this woman. Death is the cut-off point. And from then on, there's only imprisonment and loneliness and despair. And on the day of judgment, final, everlasting ruin. God in the end will withdraw all his good gifts from those who don't want him. And then all that's left is darkness and torment and despair and loneliness. But he hasn't done that for any man or woman who is still alive here in this world. The very fact that they are still alive means that however wicked they are, God is still showing them kindness. He's protecting them. He's providing for them. And Jesus says to his disciples, if God can treat them like that, then you must do the same. Be merciful, he says. Verse 36, just as your Father is merciful. So that's our motivation, to be like God. Jesus was perfectly like God. He is the perfect reflection of God's character and God's behavior. He is the perfect image bearer. You know, trying to be like God just by an effort of your will is pointless. You know, it'd be easy for somebody to misunderstand what I've said this morning. It'd be easy for them to think that all I'm saying is that everybody needs to work harder at being like God. That's not what I'm saying. Because however hard you work at it, you can't do it. The damage that sin has done to you is just too great. What you need is to be saved. What you need is to be joined to Jesus Christ. What you need is for a living union, a unity, to be created between you and Jesus Christ, God's Son. Because if that happens, if you're united to him, then you can begin to be like him. And that means you can begin to be like God. Every one of you here this morning who's a real Christian has already got that amazing privilege. You've already been joined to Jesus Christ. And that means that you can be like God. You can begin to obey these commands. But for those of you who have never come to Jesus Christ, those of you who have never come confessing your helplessness and your hopelessness, those of you who have never begged Jesus Christ to save you, that's what you must do. You must come to him. You must beg him to unite you to himself by the Spirit. You must put yourself into the hands of Jesus Christ, the only Savior. He's the only one who can make the impossible possible. He's the only one who can give you grace truly to love your enemies. You may, by great willpower, manage to put up a show of tolerating your enemies. But if you're really to love them, then you're going to need Jesus Christ in your heart. Come to him. He's the only Saviour.